One is a short, black-and-white Christmas tale about three outlaws caring for a baby. The other, an even more Western take, starring John Wayne and featuring a much more pleasant storyline. And yet the other is an anime feature from Satoshi Kon, taking the outlaws and replacing them with a trio of outsiders on the streets of Tokyo at Christmas time. Hell's Heroes, Three Godfathers, and Tokyo Godfathers. They remade it.
And welcome back to another episode of They Remade It. I'm your host, Stuart.
And I'm your host, Jacob.
And happy holidays to one and all. The December month of holidays and assorted religious gatherings are upon us. I personally just kind of am just hoping for some presents and some food and for the weather to stay nice. But let's see if that happens this year. Why don't we?
Yeah, it's already not looking great weather-wise. Mm-hmm. At least it looks pretty nasty here. But yeah, I'm... excited to get into the holidays this time around. I mean, similarly to Halloween, we usually take on a Christmas feature as well. Or, well, yeah, Christmas. you can say holiday time, but there's not a lot of movies that we can pull from for our remake thing in the other categories, I hate to say.
Yeah, and as it were, there are enough remakes of Christmas things, but not enough that we feel worth our time, so... There's a lot of cases where it's just kind of like, oh, so it's still the same Christmas shit. Okay. Like, whatever.
Yeah.
But, I mean, got a unique one we've got a unique one this time around.
Oh, yeah. I was very excited to sort of learn about the differing connections here. But, I mean, this is only our third one. We did Miracle on 34th, and we did the various Grinch movies last year. But this has been a pretty holiday-heavy year. We did our two Halloween movies, and we also did Independence Day for Independence Day. So I figured, why not return to this well?
Yeah. Holidays and shit. I wonder if they did one for Arbor Day.
It's a boring Arbor Day, Charlie Brown or something, maybe.
Ooh, what if we did Treasure Island and Treasure Planet for Talk Like a Pirate Day?
I've passed that around in the before. Not specifically for that day. But I've been like, you know, we could do Treasure Island and Treasure Planet. Hell, if we wanted to do a threefer, we could do Muppet Treasure Island. Do a fourth Muppet movie. But, yeah.
God, we've done four. Yeah, we've done three. Jesus.
Yeah. We love the Muppets here. Well, I do.
Have you been watching any Muppets? Awkward segue.
No, I have not. But actually, why don't you tell me what you've been doing?
Yes. I've actually watched quite a lot. I've actually kind of shifted to the other side of the spectrum of I keep forgetting to watch things. And like I mentioned before, my partner and I, Hannah, are trying to go through a bunch of movies that she's never seen and a few that I also haven't that we found on various lists as movies you should try to see.
Oh, yeah. Last time you had mentioned you guys watched The Fifth Element and you were going to watch Shawshank. I think that was the last update.
Yes, we didn't watch Shawshank immediately after, at least. I think in order, I'll touch on each one a little, but there's quite a few, so I'll try not to drag it out. The one we watched directly after Fifth Element was Talladega Nights, the Ricky Bobby story, the Will Ferrell and, you know, John C. Reilly vehicle, because it's a NASCAR movie. It was hilarious. It's just that absurdist shit that is kind of like their whole deal that was later expanded on with, like, you know, Step Brothers and the like. I like it. Obviously, it's just kind of pretty just absurd humor stuff. After that one, there's a whole range to all of these. After that one, we watched Goodfellas, one of the Scorsese movies I do really like. Hannah loved it, liked it surprisingly more than I expected. I told her pretty much going into it, you don't have to see, if you have to see a single mob movie, watch Goodfellas. Like, you don't have to worry about Godfather and that sort of thing. Just do Goodfellas and you're done. I think it was a good one. I still adore that movie. I think it's a pretty damn good masterpiece. For as much as any mob movie can be, I suppose. Which, I say that, then Godfather still considered that, but still. After that, we watched Thelma and Louise. Simply because Hannah actually recently got a part in a play called Sordid Lives. And as part of her character, one of her things that her character is that she watches the movie, the character watches the movie Thelma and Louise and gets inspired by that to basically hold up a bar. It's a bit more silly in the play than that sounds. But suffice to say, that was a much more intense movie than I would have expected. Also surprisingly gay in the end.
Oh, it's very...
It's, yeah, I should have realized that kind of going into it. I was like, oh yeah, this must have been a pretty one of those early forms of movies of like this particular subgenre. I liked it. Kind of a, you know, obviously a bit of an abrupt ending, I will say. It's pretty much just, yeah, I mean, I won't spoil it for those who haven't seen it because I hadn't even known the ending. It's definitely one of those movies really? That most people know how it ends. Yeah, like, even when we were at the ending and she's like, oh my god, are they gonna jump? And I'm like, do you not know?
Yeah. It's like, oh wow, wait, this is a really good choice for a story.
Oh, awesome! Yeah, this worked out great. Pretty abrupt ending. And I realize I just said no spoiler. Like, yeah, I'll try not to spoil. Then I immediately said spoiler. What? Whatever.
Or something. Whatever.
You don't have to. It's fine. It's funnier if you didn't. But yeah, we watched that one. I feel like I'm skipping one because we watched a few in pretty quick succession. But after that one, then we finally watched Shawshank, which I adore. I think Hannah wasn't as into, but she liked it. It's one of several movies that truly can make me cry, especially the Brooks story. Like, that shit kills me every time. So, sad movie, but a good movie, ultimately. We then shifted, because that was a very emotionally charged movie, and then watched Step Brothers.
Okay.
That's the last one we watched, and it was... I didn't realize it was a rated R movie, which made sense going, like, once you started being in it and everything, I was like, oh, yeah, no, this is basically just if they're allowed to do even more bullshit than in Talladega Nights. Yeah, I thought it was fine. I thought it was pretty funny. I still prefer Talladega. But, you know, it's a pretty famous movie at this point, if only for all the assorted quotes that people make from it. But yeah, we both liked it pretty well.
Yeah, Ricky Bobby is sort of one end of the Will Ferrell spectrum that I really like, and Step Brothers is at the other end of that spectrum that I really dislike. Where I...
Oh, really?
Yeah, he always plays these heightened and occasionally arch characters. Like, I like him, and I like him in Talladega Nights. I like him in, Zoolander. I like him in that.
Oh, yeah.
As the villain, because they're these very heightened sort of archy characters that can get away with shit. But then movies like Elf and Step Brothers, it's the same heightened sensibilities, but it's like very man-childish, and I just don't really find that funny. So it's always a coin toss whether I'm gonna like Will Ferrell in something or not, because I'm like, okay, what type of character is he playing? I could kind of say the same thing about Adam Sandler.
Right. I gotta say, as far as character tropes go, Manchild is probably just one of the most unenjoyable as a whole, in my opinion, just because it's like, you can't really do anything with it. It's just, okay, dude is being immature, and that's about it. And it's not really that funny. Like, that's why I've never really gotten a lot of, you know, Seth Rogen's stuff that was in that vein. Obviously, he's done a lot more, like, a wider breadth of things than that, especially more recently. But just, like, the trope that he kind of built of himself, I was just never into. And the same, yeah, like you said, kind of the same for Elf. I cannot deal with Elf. People have tried to, like, go on and on about how good it is. I kind of hate it. I do. Like, it's just kind of annoying at a certain point. I still don't really want to see Stranger Than Fiction, just simply for the fact of it's a bit of a different style of his, where he's actually... Not quite his normal Archie self.
I like that one because he's not weird. And I mean, the author woman isn't weird either. It's just a weird situation that they both find themselves in, but they're normal characters. So I do like that one.
Yeah. That's the extent of what we've been watching, which is honestly quite a bit. Beyond that, I have been just kind of playing games off and on. I've been taking a break from Baldur's Gate just because I kind of burned myself out on it a little. But at a certain point, the amount of jankiness in it got kind of frustrating, and it's just like, and I mentioned that last time around, so I won't, you know, rehash that again. It can just be kind of glitchy for me. Maybe it's just my case. I just have a pretty bad run of bad luck with that, but I don't know. It feels like every other quest has a chance of just like soft locking for one reason or another. So that one's just kind of had to step away from for a minute. Otherwise I've been playing through, I don't know if you'll remember this one. It's called Sleeping Dogs. The Kung Fu Hong Kong style game, like kind of taking, like, aping off of like the old like Hong Kong Kung Fu movie era of stuff. It's pretty solid. I can understand why it's kind of held up. It's a bit absurd at times, being like, oh, you're meant to be this undercover cop and you're doing truly the most egregious things at times. I'm like, Jesus. I don't know what department's gonna be cool with this. Like, having watched Infernal Affairs, I feel like there's a limit. but yeah, that's the one I've been playing through, and I'm also trying to play back through, I don't know if I mentioned it before, it's called Tunic.
I mentioned that on the show when it came out.
Oh, yeah, that's true, that's true. That one I'm just kind of trying to go back through. It's a very interesting game. I've basically blown through the first three major bosses this time around because, you know, now that I actually know what I'm doing, it's like, oh, okay, let's go. Which I guess is sort of the point of a game, is like, if you know what you're doing, you can do a whole lot early on. But, you know, it's, it's been pretty fun. I'm going to try to get all the extra secrets and everything and try to get the proper ending, but dear God, some of them are esoteric as hell. I'm not the completionist, and I am far too non-clever to be able to put up with a lot of that stuff.
I'm actually surprised, not just to hear that you're playing through it, but that apparently you gave it a go before, because I remember when I first brought it up on the show and I was explaining, like, how the in-game manual worked, you said that you thought you would hate that. I would hate that.
I think with the way you brought it up, I didn't realize like how it got integrated into the world. Like I didn't realize whenever you started playing it. And I think whenever I did pick it up, I think because it's on Game Pass for free. I think I just picked it up one evening. I just kind of on a lark, just be like, this looks like something. And I just started playing it, and I just kind of played it in my off time. I guess I just forgot to ever bring it up. I didn't realize kind of like in the sense of it also acts as like a storytelling mechanism of kind of like both the world and also like the mechanics and how you integrate into it and everything. That one I think. That's what really gripped me. Like those moments of when you first realize, oh shit, that's what that does.
It's like, I gotcha.
It's yeah. So that's been a lot of fun. It's fun rediscovering that a bit. Obviously having played through, I think most of it the first time around. I now know most of the mechanics already, but still, it's still pretty cool. That's kind of been the extent of it, quite a bit more than before.
Definitely. So I hope you continue on your train of, self-discovery with movies, even if you've seen a good chunk of them in.
Yeah.
It's more so games, fun. But
well, yeah, but it's cool seeing it from another perspective. Like again, like the Thelma and Louise thing. It's like, holy shit, cool.
You don't know that. How is this possible? We'll watch Sixth Sense next.
Oh my god, that one I think she does know by reputation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she has not watched a whole lot of movies, and so it's really fun discovering these moments, like the moment in Shawshank with a poster and like the hole in the wall. That was like, she doesn't know what's coming. This is awesome.
Beautiful. We all speak a universal language.
Yeah. that's about it. What about you?
Very similarly to you, I watched a ton of things, and I'm not going to talk about all of them. So,
okay.
I don't remember if I mentioned it in the last episode we recorded for Men in Black or not, but shortly after that recording, for my birthday, I personally took 2 weeks off of work.
Nice.
It was like my birthday, I'll take time off, and it'll thread right into the Thanksgiving break. So I essentially got 12 days off of work, not including weekends. So I had a lot of time, and according to my Letterboxd account, I watched 28 movies in that span of time.
Jesus, so, wept.
I was coding for a day on a personal project, and I spent all day working on it, and so I just had things running on my computer in the background, and I have two monitors, so it was right there, and I just, like, plowed through all of the Saw movies, just because they were on Shudder. And I was like, I've seen like two of these. I've seen Saw 1 and Saw 3 all the way through, but the rest of them, it was just like clips here and there. So I was like, okay, I'll just watch all the Saw movies. What a wretched franchise.
I was expecting that reaction.
Yeah. I always assumed I would have that opinion based on the clips that I saw, but even watching it, I was like, this isn't like, I don't even like any of the actors in this. Like, this just is not redeemable at all. And like Saw 1, I think I was always mixed on. In my opinion tends to change. It's like, oh no, it's pretty cool for a horror because a lot of it is like a bottle set in this one location. And then other times I'll think about it again. I'll be like, well, yeah, but they're constantly cutting to the police station and there's flashbacks, so they kind of ruin it. You know, so even the first one, which is widely lauded as the best, I'm like, how much do I like Saw 1? So,
how much does anyone truly like Saw 1? Let's be honest here.
There's some people that love Saw 1.
I know. You'd be surprised how many people on Tumblr like have like these weird like cutesy things going on, like cutesy aesthetic boards having to do with like characters from Saw, and I was like, I need y'all to like try to fight the brain rot, like just a little. Yeah. Like I just
Saw and Amanda together forever.
I'm like, oh my god. Like if I have to see people thirsting after Hoffman that one more time, I'm gonna be like, get your brain fixed, please.
Yikes.
I have seen honestly a fair number of them. A lot it showed up on HBO a few times. I think I've seen all the way through the first three, and then, like, I don't know, I think it's, like, 7 and 8. And, like, I skipped most of the middle ones. I know that much. No, sorry, six. I think it's like 6 and 7 is what it would be. Gotta say, yeah, no, I agree.
All right, so you skipped 4 and 5. You didn't watch Jigsaw, and you haven't watched Chris Rock's Spiral, a book I have, Jigsaw.
That is correct, yes. I kind of agree. I think the first two are pretty decent. I like this. For some reason, I found myself liking the second one a bit more, just because I kind of like the concept of, like, the fact that they're just talking to the main villain right there, like, the whole time, and that's kind of the whole, the whole shtick of it. I thought that was just kind of an interesting concept of, like, okay, we're actually kind of playing around with it. We're showing that, you know, this guy is a villain of intellect more than anything else, which is, you know, interesting. Obviously, I think John Kramer as a character is the strongest character in the entire series, which is, you know, the reason they keep bringing his old ass out.
Yeah, I mean, Tobin Bell carries that series, and he's fine. He's fine for the performance. I don't think he does a bad job. I just don't like the character. Like, I've seen him in other stuff. Like, he has he's like the owner of a record store in an episode of Seinfeld. I remember.
Oh yeah,
like, I like him.
It's weird seeing him in other shit. It's sort of like, oh hey, what are you doing here?
Yeah. I do think that a lot of what is in Saw 2 is at least interesting. I will go with you on that, but. Donnie Wahlberg cannot carry a movie.
Dear God. Oh, dear God.
He is awful.
So. Bad. It's real bad. And I'll say this is the last thing I'll say about it, just because I'm waffling pretty hard. But I think the best way I heard someone describe the Saw movies, it's like, especially like, you know, John Kramer's, you know, ethos as a whole, is it's Catholic guilt with none of the aesthetic. it's like, you know what? Yeah, that's all this is. It's Catholic guilt recontextualized.
Yeah, except the stupidest shit. Like, you come in front of me at the DMV, so I'm driving nails into your back.
My God, yeah. Like, it's going to get, like, this cutting into, like, to the more and more obscure ways people have somehow wronged this poor old man. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
It's just like, whatever, man. Like, you got issues.
Whatever. It doesn't even matter that he's been dead since, like, movie 2. And they just keep...
Yeah.
It's all flashbacks and shit, but...
At this point, I want them to jump the shark and straight up just bring him back to life. Like, just fully go, no, this man has somehow defied death. We saw him being autopsied on in one of the movies, and still.
They need to go paranormal with that franchise if they want to keep it interesting instead of making this big ball. Like, even Saw X, which is the one I have not seen because it only just came out of theaters, like, a month ago, so I still haven't seen Saw X. But he's back in that one, and this time it's like, okay, at the very least, I know the conceit is not a flashback. It's like... the movie takes place between Saw 1 and 2, so there's a reason for him to still be alive. But still, it's like, go paranormal, bring him back from the dead as, like, an evil zombie, or he makes a deal with the devil to send sinners down to him, or he possesses the puppet, Billy the Puppet, and he rides him around. Like, do something. Anything.
Like Scarface Batman villain style.
Yeah, it's...
That'd be hilarious. He's
the real mastermind.
And you can even skirt around to being explicitly paranormal by saying, like, oh, some dude finds the jigsaw puzzle, and he suddenly starts getting compulsions to continue the work. Like... Yeah, like, maybe this guy's just crazy, but maybe it's actually John Kramer's ghost. Who knows?
Maybe he's possessed by Tobin Bell. That'd be interesting. Yeah.
See, there's a concept. Someone pay me for that. That's a good one.
We can make movies.
I feel like we have no right to make movies.
Well, anyways.
Andrew, sorry.
No, that's okay. So that's all the Saw movies. I rewatched a couple of things. I rewatched the 89 Batman and Beetlejuice for, like, a Tim Burton-y thing. I watched... The first three Wishmaster movies, the first two are Wes Craven films, and then the other two are direct-to-DVD. I still haven't seen Wishmaster 4. I'm dragging my feet.
Yeah. I didn't know there were four. I only thought there were two.
There's the third one and the fourth one are direct-to-DVD. The third one takes place on, like, a college campus, and it's not Divoff, it's some other guy. And the fourth one, I haven't seen the fourth one, but he, like... It's the same fucking thing every time where someone breaks it and he's like, you have to grant these three wishes or I'm gonna blah, blah, blah. But he, like, starts to fall in love with the woman. I'm just like, I'll do that at some point, I'm sure. But,
Oh, then.
So yeah, all over the place with that. But I really wanted to talk about the three new things that I watched. And I won't spend too long on them. First, I did see Disney's centennial feature Wish. I went ahead and watched it.
How'd that go? I've been hearing some mixed things.
I think some people are being too negative. I think it's fine. I think it's perfectly fine. Which honestly is a lot better than I can say for a good chunk of their recent output. So, is it worse than the movies that they've been releasing since 2019, 2020? I honestly don't really think so. I think it's better than those, but is it going to be like a classic? Hell no. And the funny thing is, the interesting thing behind why I personally think that it's, like, a decent enough Disney movie is that it's literally just, because it's their centennial, it's going back to basics, and it's like, here's an evil villain who is, like, the ruler of a land, and you know he's evil from the get-go, like, we did it in the trailers and the poster and everything, like, it's not some secret twisty villain that they've, like, you know, they've been doing for fucking years. No. Oh, didn't we surprise you? It was the mayor's aide all along. No, you know he's the bad guy. A lot of, like, fantastical princessy shit. The story's simple. There's not, like, a bunch of generational trauma or, like, my mom's mean to me that's thrown in there. It's a simple story, which is all I ask for.
Yeah, it's amazing how low the bar has become, isn't it?
Exactly. And for what it's worth, I think Chris Pine as the villain, as the king, is the best part of the movie and is actually entertaining, because it's fun. You know, if I didn't know how long animated films took to develop, I would think that they were like literally taking a page out of the book of Puss in Boots and the Last Wish. Cause I was like, you know, finally a villain who's just a villain, you know, he's just a son of a bitch that thinks, well, in this case, you know, he's like, I am doing this for other people, but eventually he, you know, he gets corrupted and he is just full-on bad guy. No redeeming qualities. The villain doesn't get redeemed, thank God. You know, just all these things I care about. But as far as negatives go, it's a musical, and the songs are very bland.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing I've heard.
Unbelievably boring. the movie is up its own ass with Disney history. There are something like over 100 Disney Easter eggs in the movie, apparently. I didn't fucking catch that many. Probably because it's like, oh, in the background is a chamber pot from Hercules. I don't give a shit.
But clouds in this area are Morse code for sex.
Some of them are really obvious because there's a guy dressed like Peter Pan whose name is Peter. I'm like, okay, why is he in the movie? And, you know, shit like that that's really kind of annoying. The one thing that I did kind of like is the main princess character has, like, 7 friends, and each one of them is, like, supposed to be the representation of one of the 7 dwarves from Snow White. And it was actually pretty subtle, and it took me a while to, like, catch on to it for the first 25 minutes of the movie, and then they just outright start stating, you wonder why I'm grumpy all the time, and it's like, okay, well, you ruined it. It's just the movie doesn't trust itself.
That kind of feels like Disney's mentality for a long time now, is that they don't really trust the audience to fucking put it together sometimes.
Yeah, and also the goat character is voiced by Alan Tudyk once he starts talking, and I want to bash that character's head in with a fucking stone. The worst character in the movie will not shut up with annoying one-liners. I'm done. I'm over it. But,
Nope. There's a special place in hell for people who write characters who exist purely to give one-liners.
Yeah. But yeah, if you can look past those 3 things that are flaws with the movie, I think it's perfectly fine. It's acceptable. I didn't despise it like I have so many other things that Disney's come out with. So I watched that. I watched Priscilla, the newest Sofia Coppola.
Cool.
I'm pretty sure that this is her first film that she shot on digital, and it shows, but the movie looks just fine enough. I'm sure it was like a cost-cutting thing, so I can't say that I really noticed all that much, so I think that's fine. But that was... enjoyable is not the right word, but I liked the movie.
Okay.
I had an interesting time with it. It's really... It's definitely it's the other side of the page from that Baz Luhrmann Elvis movie that came out last year, which I still have not seen because I'm not a big Baz Luhrmann fan, but I understand it is very it's very Elvis loving, and to a degree this movie is Elvis loathing, this Priscilla movie. Not necessarily in the ways you'd expect, because he's not like an outright villainous character. It's like, oh, imagine that, a movie is showing a historical figure to be complex instead of like a good or an evil. Like I the same thing for Nolan with Oppenheimer earlier in the year. It's like, oh, look, it's a guy who can say whether this person is right or wrong in what they're doing.
All he knows is that this guy took a lot of drugs.
Yes. Kaylee Spaney is Priscilla, and she's a real powerhouse in this. Really gets off like the unsettled moods, like when the rot starts to form between Priscilla and Elvis's marriage. So yeah, no, that was Priscilla. Again, I think it's a very good movie. I don't think I'd call it fun or enjoyable or anything like that, just because of the type of movie it is.
It's like watching a whale.
Yeah. Oh, that was depressing. For a number of reasons.
Yeah.
Finally, for movies, The Holdovers. With Paul Giamatti, my man.
Oh, yeah.
I've been interested in seeing this one since I got the trailer, because it was a very grainy, like, 70s style trailer, and I was like, oh, that looks interesting. Even like the whiplash you get from the trailer, where it's comedy, and then halfway through the trailer it's like, oh, but this is serious. I was like, oh, you know what, they're selling me on this. It's like I've been sent back in time. So I watched the holdovers. Paul Giamatti, as expected, is great. I do like him. He's usually playing such a despicable, like, creepy bastard, and it's kind of the same in this one, but he's also just like, there's a reason he's a bastard. He's like a depressed, aging nothing that nobody likes. It's like, yeah, okay. Is this Paul Giamatti, yeah, no, or is this the character?
So I was about to say, I was like, oh, damn. Played to strength, are we?
Yeah. I like him in the movie. Dominic Sessa is like the main child character. I don't think I've seen him in anything else, but he's also very enjoyable. He's sort of all over the screen. I think his character has bipolar disorder, and it's never addressed. And
I mean, that's kind of how it was in the 70s.
Yeah, so we're not going to
talk about that. Just a lot of the concept of mental illness hadn't really been ingrained in a healthy way just yet.
Yeah.
Some people were just, you know, like that.
Oh, that's just, you know, that guy sucks. That's just, you know, how he was born, I guess.
He didn't have autism back in my day. Now, excuse me while I go into my basement and build my 2,000 square foot fucking model railroad set.
I think Paul Giamatti, his character, has autism in this movie, potentially. But that's not for me to decide. He also has a lazy eye, and he apparently smells like rotting fish, according to the movie. So this guy's life is just, oh man, it's miserable. So
that would have been before, you know, prescription grade like deodorant. That sucks.
Yeah. And just the 70s thing, it goes past the trailer. This film, it's funny, I'm talking about how all these films were shot. The Holdovers was definitely shot on digital, but they try their damnedest to make it look like it was shot on film, and like they used a camera from the 70s, and it's all After Effects. It's the grainy look of it, and occasionally while you're watching, there will be like a little blip near one of the sides of the screen from burnout, where it's like, oh, this film reel's been used a bunch of times. And normally that's like an interesting gimmick, but the fact that this movie, with the trailer and the setting and the fact it takes place in 1971, I want to say, so it's really selling the whole vibe. But just the way that the movie is shot even like screams 1970s. There's honest to God like pans and zooms in the movie with like shaky cam. It's like I'm watching a movie from 1974, honest to God. Like, not just like the After Effects, but the camera person, the cinematography. It's like, this is a 70s movie, and I loved that so much. There's a moment that I think is in the trailer where Paul Giamatti realizes that one of his students has sort of fled the building, and he's supposed to be watching him, so he runs outside the building, and it's a close-up on his face, and as he screams, the camera really quickly zooms out to show the entirety of the school building, and I was like, when's the last time like I saw something like that in a movie? Probably fairly recently, because of how many old things I watched, but in a new movie, no.
Yeah, there's an art to camera movement that isn't really used so much anymore, now that we have so many effects and everything. I mean, hell, I had that with Goodfellas, of like, you know, I had that moment of, oh, hey, this is one of the really famous one shot that I got to tell Hannah about. I was like, yay!
Yeah.
one of my favorite movie facts.
Show where the pan, zoom, and Jaws is still maybe my favorite.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Very good. And films are aping it because of how good it is. I think even the Slender Man movie had a scene like a shot like that from a couple years ago, and I was like, everyone knows how good this is.
even the shit movies.
Yeah. But that's The Holdovers, and for my money, that's one of my favorite movies of the year. I really liked it. Even for as maudlin and treacle-y as it can get, I think a big chunk of it is just like the gall to make a movie this way and have it play theatrically. It's just such a show stopper. I think that people watching this at home, maybe they will, but I don't think they'll get the same experience as seeing it in the theater, just because it's like,
right,
it's kind of like a circus trick at a point. But the movie's not bad on its own, and I like all the actors in it. So, good movie. Nice. Great movie.
Fantastic.
And the last thing.
Check it out.
The last thing before we finally get into movie talk, I'll only go on this briefly. It's a video game, a secret video game, in that I didn't know it released until a couple weeks after it came out, but there was a sequel made to one of my favorite puzzle games. The Talos Principle 2 came out.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
I've been driving my way through it. I love playing puzzle games and like challenging myself and being like, I'm not gonna look anything up. I'm just, if I get stuck on something for an hour and a half, so be it. And it's so much fun. I'm at the point where I'm finally almost done with the main story. I think I have like two puzzles left in the final zone before I can get to the end game. But even then, there's so many secrets and things, like monument puzzles that I have to figure out. I'm having a blast with Talos Principle 2. And the scope is a lot bigger, and there's, like, voice acting and cutscenes. Like, you can tell that Digital Devolver was like, yeah, you guys, make this, like, a game. You know, the Talos Principle 1 is a game, but you guys should make this, like, a game.
And like, so, more like, game?
Somehow more game. Yeah, and as usual, the conversations can be very frustrating, especially with some of the characters like the Sphinx, because it's just like the first game. It's basically there is no right answer. Anything you pick, they are going to play devil's advocate and argue with you. that's how the game is. So, like, but I love it. Like,
I get enough of this shit in real life.
Yeah, it's very much, you know, theoretical. Like, what does it mean to be human? But it does it in an interesting way that I don't think has been done before. Like, just the fact that you're basically in a society of robots, but it's not like, are we human? What does it mean to be human? We are just code. It's like, no, they call themselves, they're robots, but they call themselves humans because what's the difference? And then any argument past that point is more so about morality and how to improve upon who they consider to be their ancestors, organic humans. It's very interesting. Something I haven't seen done before.
What makes us human is the ability to make a damn good pot of macaroni and cheese.
Mm.
No other species can do that.
I think taking out a loan to buy a Toyota Corolla, maybe.
Mm-hmm. It's also solid. Also solid.
But that is the Talos Principle 2, and my nice little segue is the town in the Talos Principle 2, which I was surprised to learn. The town is called New Jerusalem, which is the name of the town in Three Godfathers, baby. So let's hop into it.
Let's go!
First up, we'll be discussing Hell's Heroes, 1929, directed by William Wyler, and based on The Three Godfathers by Peter B. Kine. Four men, Bob Sangster, played by Charles Bickford, Barb Wire Gibbons, played by Raymond Hatton, Wild Bill Kearney, played by Fred Kohler, and Jose, played by Joe Dela Cruz, rob the bank in the town of New Jerusalem. Jose and the cashier are killed, while Barb Wire is shot in the shoulder. The three outlaws escape the posse led by the sheriff, played by Walter James, fleeing into the desert. However, their horses run off in a sandstorm, and they have little water. When they reach a waterhole, they are dismayed to find that not only is it dry, but there is a pregnant woman stranded there, played by Fritzi Ridgeway. She gives birth to a boy. Before she dies from her ordeal, she makes the three the child's godfathers and begs them to take him to his father, Frank Edwards, who just so happens to be the cashier that the three murdered. Bob wants to abandon the boy, but the other two are determined to honor the woman's request. They start walking the 40 miles to New Jerusalem. Weakened by his wound, Barb Wire eventually can go no further. He makes the others continue without him, then shoots himself. That night, they stop to rest. When Bob wakes up the next morning, he finds Bill gone. A note Bill left explains he went further into the desert to conserve the little remaining water for Bob and the baby. Bob goes on discarding his belongings along the way, including finally the loot that they had stolen. At one point, he leaves the baby, but then picks him up again. That's how movies progress. His strength gives out just as he reaches a waterhole with a sign warning that it's poisoned with arsenic. Desperate, he comes up with a plan to save the baby. He drinks his fill, knowing that he will have about an hour before it kills him, and then stumbles back into New Jerusalem's church, where the congregation is celebrating Christmas. Finally, his task being completed, he dies without uttering a word. And now the plot to Three Godfathers from 1948, directed by John Ford and also based on Peter B. Kine's novel. Three rustlers, Bob Hightower, played by John Wayne, Pete, played by Pedro Armendariz, and the Abilene Kid, played by Harry Carey Jr., ride into welcome Arizona. They have a friendly conversation with Sheriff Buck Sweet, played by Ward Bond, and his wife, played by Mae Marsh, who ask if they have seen their niece and their husband on the trail. The three subsequently rob the local bank, but the loot is lost when Kid is shot and the horse falls. They flee into the desert on two horses, pursued by Sweet and his men in a buckboard. Sweet shoots a hole in their water bag, and he then turns back to the depot. The fugitives come within sight of the railroad's water tank, only to see Sweet station a guard. Doubling back to Terrapin Tanks, a granite sump at the edge of the desert, the robbers lose their horses in a sandstorm. Desperate for water, they find the tanks dynamited by a tenderfoot who disappeared chasing his thirsting horses. In a covered wagon nearby lies the man's wife, Sweet's niece-in-law, played by Mildred Natwick, who is in labor. When Pete helps with the delivery, the other two laboriously collect water from nearby cacti. Many hours later, the woman has a boy whom she names Robert William Pedro Hightower after her benefactors. Before dying, she exacts a promise from them to save him and be his godfathers. Moved, the three desperados keep their vow. They find a chest filled with baby things, condensed milk, an advice book, and a Bible. Pete offers Bob the Bible for guidance, but Bob slaps it aside. Kid, certain that a higher power guided them there, compares the baby to the infant Jesus in the manger and themselves as the three wise men. Inspired by a Bible verse, they head for the town of New Jerusalem, across the desert and over a mountain. The posse later comes upon this abandoned wagon, and, recognizing the possessions of his niece-in-law, Sweet believes that the fugitives killed her and sets out for revenge. When they cross a salt flat, Kid collapses, and he dies. Okay. Once past the flat, Pete trips, breaking his leg. He asks Bob to leave him his pistol for coyotes, but as Bob walks toward the mountain, he hears a single gunshot. Staggering through a ravine, Bob finally falls, but in his delirium, the ghosts of his two friends refuse to let him give up. Finding a donkey and her colt at the end of the ravine, he uses them to reach New Jerusalem, where he stumbles into a cantina to get drinks for himself and the baby. Just as Sheriff Sweet catches up with him, Bob collapses from exhaustion. Bob is jailed and welcome, but with his heroic rescue of the baby, the entire town has become sympathetic towards him. Bob gives his godchild into the temporary custody of the Sweets, now his friends, but when the judge asks him to give up custody permanently in exchange for a suspended sentence, he refuses to break his promise to the baby's mother. Pleased, the judge gives him the minimum sentence of a year and a day, and as he leaves for prison, all the townspeople give Bob a rousing farewell. Alright, moving on to Tokyo Godfathers from 2003, directed by Satoshi Kon, and based instead on the Three Godfathers film from 1948, directed by John Ford, instead of the book. But, I mean, it inherits that. That's how this works. Starting off, before going into the synopsis, I'll run through the cast list real quick, just because I'm going to give the person who voiced in the sub and also the person who voiced in the dub, and I figured it would be more complete to just do that beforehand instead of trying to do it in the middle of the synopsis. So we have Toru Emery, or John Avner, who played Gin, Yoshiaki Umegaki and Shakina Nafak voiced Hana, Aya Okamoto and Victoria Grace voiced Miyuki, Satomi Korogi and Carrie Walgren voiced Kyoko, the baby, Kyoko Tarasi and Larissa Gallagher played Sachiko, Makimo Noto and Erica Schroeder voiced Kyoko, a different Kyoko, who is Gin's daughter, Hiroya Ishimura and Kirk Thornton both voiced Yasuo, Yosaku Yara and Crispin Freeman voiced Ishida, and Akio Otsuka and Jameson Price voiced Isha. One Christmas Eve, three homeless people, a middle-aged alcoholic named Gin, a trans woman named Hana, and a dependent teenage runaway named Miyuki, discover an abandoned newborn while searching through the garbage for presents. On the baby is a note asking the finder to take good care of her, and a key leading to a bag with clues to the parents' identity. The trio sets out to find the parents. Hana names the baby Kyoko based on the Japanese translation of Silent Night, literally meaning pure child. Outside a cemetery, the group encounters a Yakuza boss trapped under his car. That day, his daughter will marry the owner of the club where Kyoko's mother used to work. At the wedding reception, the groom tells them that the baby's mother is a former bar girl named Sachiko. He gives them Sachiko's address, but the party is interrupted when a Latino hitman attempts to shoot the bride's father. The hitman kidnaps Miyuki and baby Kyoko, holding them hostage and taking them to his home. There, Miyuki befriends the hitman's wife, and they begin bonding despite their language barrier. During one of their talks, Miyuki confesses to fleeing her home after stabbing her controlling father when her beloved cat Angel went missing, because she believed he got rid of it. Hana searches for Miyuki and Kyoko while Gin takes care of an elderly homeless man who is dying in the street. After giving Gin a little red bag, the old man peacefully passes away. Some teenagers show up and beat up Gin and the man's corpse. Well, meanwhile, Hana finds the girls and, looking for a place to stay, they go to Angel Tower, a club where Hana had worked at before assaulting a rude and intoxicated customer years prior. Oi. Gin, rescued by another member of the club, is also there. Here, it is revealed that Hana became homeless when her lover died after slipping on a bar of soap in the bathroom. The trio later discover that Sachiko's house had been torn down. They are informed of the unhappy relationship between Sachiko and her husband, who is a gambling alcoholic, and Miyuki then sees a message from her father in the newspaper informing her that Angel has returned home. Realizing her mistake, Miyuki attempts to call her father, only to panic and hang up before she can say a word. The group rests at a store until they are told to leave by the clerk, and Hana collapses and Gin and Miyuki take her to the hospital. Once there, Gin finds his estranged daughter, who is also named Kyoko, working as a nurse. Hana berates Gin in front of his daughter and storms out of the hospital, with Miyuki following behind with baby Kyoko in hand. Hana and Miyuki find Sachiko about to jump off a bridge, with Sachiko insisting that her husband got rid of the baby without her knowledge, and Hana and Miyuki return the baby to her. Gin finds Sachiko's husband, who confirms that Kyoko was stolen by Sachiko from the hospital. They chase after Sachiko and Kyoko. Miyuki chases Sachiko to the top of a building, with Sachiko revealing she became pregnant, hoping it would bring her closer to her husband. When her baby was stillborn, she decided to kidnap Kyoko from the hospital, thinking in her grief the baby was hers. Sachiko jumps off the building, but Miyuki manages to catch her before she falls, but then Sachiko accidentally drops Kyoko. Hana jumps off the building, catching the baby and clinging to a banner on the side of the building. As the banner begins to give way, a gust of wind miraculously slows its descent, allowing Hana and Kyoko to land safely on the ground. Hana, Miyuki, and Gin are taken to the hospital. And during their reunion, Miyuki drops the old man's red bag on the floor, revealing a winning lottery ticket. Kyoko's real parents want to ask the trio to become her godparents, and when the police inspector introduces them, the inspector is revealed to be Miyuki's father. And that's three movies there.
Or with the last one.
Yeah, quite a lot going on. Characters split up and do their own thing, and then they meet up, and then they go do their own thing again. And
not necessarily a bad thing, just like, holy shit.
Oh, no, I like it. It's just, it's hard to describe. But yeah, let's do full circle. We got a number of things here. Firstly, I wrote it down because it is the only connection we have for 1929's Hell's Heroes. Edward Hearn plays Frank Edwards, who was the cashier that was shot and killed. He was also a sanitarium attendant in 1937's A Star is Born. Moving on to Three Godfathers, Jane Darwell was Miss Flory in Three Godfathers. She was also Ma Stone in 1941's All That Money Can Buy, also known as The Devil and Daniel Webster. That is a character that I remember being very fond of in a movie that I was not very fond of. Hank Warden was Deputy Curly in Three Godfathers. He was also an undertaker in both 1962's The Music Man and 1969's True Grit, another John Wayne movie.
A weird one to get typecast into.
Yeah, yeah, you're the undertaker now. Not the wrestler. They had to explain that back then, too.
I'll be ahead of their time.
Oh, yeah, they knew what was coming. Speaking of True Grit, John Wayne, who played Robert Hightower in Three Godfathers, he was Rooster Cogburn in 69's True Grit. The man himself.
Oh, Mr. Wayne, you hammy motherfucker.
Ward Bond was Buck Sweet, the sheriff, in Three Godfathers. He was also Detective Pullhouse in 1941's The Maltese Falcon.
Oh, yeah.
Ben Johnson was one of the posse men in Three Godfathers. He showed up as Mr. Mason in 1984's Red Dawn.
Oh, yeah. There's so many characters in this where it's just like, oh, yeah.
That guy. Speaking of so many characters, Francis Ford, Gertrude Astor, Harry Tenbrook, Jack Curtis, Jack Moore, Mae Marsh, and Ruth Clifford all were various characters in The Three Godfathers. And over the course of our podcast, we have seen them in the likes of 1925's The Phantom of the Opera, 1931's Frankenstein, 1932's Scarface, 1937's A Star is Born, 1941's The Wolfman, 1941's The Maltese Falcon, and 1947's Miracle on 34th Street.
Yes.
Three Godfathers has a lot of people in it that we've discussed before.
God, that whole era was just like a whole bunch of people just who knew each other just hanging out.
Yeah, get in here, we're making a Western. And then finally, moving on to Tokyo Godfathers, Akio Utsuka was Isha in the sub of Tokyo Godfathers, was also the voice of Bato in 1995's The Ghost in the Shell. I sound like my grandfather. And Koichi Yamadera was the taxi driver. He also voiced Togusa in 1995's Ghost in the Shell. So, two connections between Ghost in the Shell and Tokyo Godfathers. And that is it for Full Circle.
Alrighty. Well, I'll give you a bit of a break on this one, because Jesus Christ. Yeah, no, I get it. And it's actually kind of fortuitous that you brought up that there was a connection with A Star is Born, because the first thing I have to say, kind of out the gate, comparing Hell's Heroes and Three Godfathers specifically, and I'll get more into Tokyo Godfathers in a moment, but there was a very consistent feeling of comparison that I had between Hell's Heroes to Three Godfathers in the comparison of What Price Hollywood and A Star Is Born, simply for the fact of one is very clearly pre-Hollywood code, the other is clearly very post-Hollywood code. And
yes,
there is such a tonal difference between the two of these. They are the exact same story, but their tone, their moral, their everything seems to be completely shifted simply for the fact of what was clearly a major change in the way movies were allowed to be made, or at least should be made if they want to be kept up to code. And it's, I will say it off the bat, it's a similar feeling to what I had between What Price Hollywood and A Star Is Born. Three Godfathers only suffered for it because Jesus Christ, that shit was saccharine by the end.
Yeah, I was actually enjoying it up until...
Yeah.
Well, weirdly enough, up until all the Bible stuff, because not because I think there's anything inherently wrong with that, because William Wyler also does the same thing in Hell's Heroes, but exactly. it's all contextual, and they don't explain it. At the point where Pedro starts going through and being like, "This is like the baby Jesus, and we're like the three wise men taking him to the," I'm like, "Okay, just settle down. You can show me without telling me." Like. It's
this sort of gushiness I can expect from one of the characters in like Singing in the Rain, not in this what is meant to be a very harrowing tale of saving a newborn child in the middle of the literal fucking desert.
Like, yeah.
My goodness gracious. It's just it became insufferable at a certain point. And we've had this issue before, obviously. Like we've had movies we've seen that have kind of gone to a place where it was like trying to turn it into like a moralistic thing. Like the original Scarface, the extra ending they had where he was like captured and hanged and everything, like that's kind of part of it. And obviously, you know, the original A Star Is Born, where it just kind of just toned down on a lot of the like more harsh tones of the movie in general. I'm just like, golly, man, like I liked this story of the original Hell's Heroes. I really did enjoy it, and it was succinct with it. And I recognized the biblical references pretty early on. Like, it's hard not to. That's kind of the whole point. But just getting beaten over the head with it, I was just like, Jesus fucking Christ, pun intended. And then it kind of all came back around with Tokyo Godfathers, wherein they played into that of like, my goodness, this child really is the messenger from God, as all this insane bullshit is happening around these people. Like, the one character, Gin, is about to like basically die on the street, and he's visited by an angel to save him, and it turns out it's just essentially a stripper. Or at least a burlesque dancer. It's like, oh, that's hilarious. It's like, that's, we're playing into it. I love that. Like, and I love.
It's funny because we can't even say it's a happy medium between Hell's Heroes and Three Godfathers. It's just, it's taking what Three Godfathers did and doing even more of it, but it knows what it's doing.
Yes. So, I think even in the description on Wikipedia, it's described as what is called a tragicomedy, which I didn't know was a specific subgenre. I get it, but at the same time, I kind of hate that term. Like,
it's not a good one. I think they're trying to, like, you know, like a dark comedy, but it's like, well, the movie's not dark. It just has dark themes, and it's more about loss. I don't know. It's a weird line.
Yeah. But I did, like, yeah, and I'm trying not to, like, just show my opinions, like, kind of right out the gate. It's just, it was very refreshing to kind of go from, oh, this is a really cool and dark kind of story in this tale of, like, harrowing, you know, trials by these, you know, outlaws and, like, the hell that they had to go through to save this child. And then it comes right back down to, oh, here's John Wayne doing John Wayne things while people, like, celebrate him, even though he is truly a rat bastard. It's just, they do everything in that movie to, like, undercut the fact that he, like, try to, like, cut away from the fact that, yeah, he's meant to be an outlaw. Like, everything the original did were, you know... It had them robbing the place basically immediately. It didn't really establish them to be superhuman characters. That is to say, to establish them as humans in a super way, not in saying that they're superhuman as in superheroes. But it doesn't really do anything to establish that. It shows that, yeah, they are kind of shitholes. And then as the time progresses, he eventually gets to the point where he has to abandon the loot as the last thing, like, to save his child. It's kind of that last moment of, I have to give this up. I have to sacrifice at least this much more to do this selfless act, and then in the end fully being this, like, the ultimate self-sacrifice in the end. And so, yeah, it has a build-up of this true moment of sacrifice, and it's very well earned. Meanwhile, in Three Godfathers, they lose the loot, like, immediately, and so it's like, okay, so all the moral, like, growth that this character can have is gone. It's just gonna come down to him being super, him being just this great guy who just does the right thing for apropos of nothing, basically.
Yeah, he doesn't have anywhere to go, and there's not, like, the interesting, like, in Hell's Heroes, for example, where he speculates leaving. Bob does, you know, in the remake, he sticks along with it, even if it's frustrating, because it's like, oh, well, we're these godfathers, and I'm not gonna go back on a word I promised a woman. Mm-hmm. But in Hell's Heroes, he's like, we need to abandon this kid in the desert. Like, there's no reason, so there's, like, room for growth. And that can kind of be, that can definitely be said about Tokyo Godfathers as well, where yeah. it's, for, I mean, initially it's just Hana that wants to keep this kid, and then the other two are like, what the fuck are you doing? We can't do this. Like, and that constantly comes up throughout the movie. Yeah, that constantly comes up throughout the movie. It's like, we're not action heroes. We live on the street. What do you want me to do?
Yeah.
And I actually really...
drunk in a gutter.
And I really did have... And I had that moment of, you know, comparison between the original and with Tokyo Godfathers. But that moment of, yeah, why don't they just take it to the police or to a hospital or something? Like, they have... They're in an active, like, modern metropolitan area. There are resources for this sort of thing. But then Hana comes in and says, no, they're going to be put into a foster home, and they're probably going to get bounced around from one place to another, and they're never going to know a real life of, like, understand a life of love and being appreciated. I'm like, oh, I see. So they're not being abandoned in a literal desert. They're being abandoned in an emotional desert. That's fucking brilliant. Let's continue.
Yeah.
Like, I just, like, they had that moment, and I had to put that piece together. I'm like, God damn it. I agree with the crazy lady.
Which is also why it's so interesting, because all these movies are set at Christmas time, but you really only get that. I mean, you get it in all the movies, obviously, because that's an ongoing theme, and it's literally they constantly bring the holiday up. But the actual environment and the setting, they only really get to in Tokyo Godfathers, because they have to supplement the desert with the snowfall. And I wish that I was Satoshi Kon when he was sort of thinking through this, and he's like, that's the perfect transposition, because instead of, like, a barren snowscape, we can have an emotionally barren... Or instead of a barren desert scape, it'd be an emotionally barren snowscape, because the snow acts as a desert in that it coats the ground, and it's like it's an environmental hazard that they have to get through. But, you know, they're freezing and buses have to stop, and it works so well as a migration from one idea to another. And
the fact of,
I wish I could have thoughts like that.
I know. And then the fact that with the originals, them being outlaws compared to the Tokyo Godfathers of them being homeless, which is still in a sense defined as an outlaw. They live outside of the protection of the law, effectively. They are people who do not have a place to go back to, and they have to, you know, fight to survive as much as any actual literal desert. Like, they are surrounded by plenty, and that yet they can have none of it. And it's just like they only survive by the few good graces of the people they happen to run into, and the people that, you know, happen to have, you know, like, comparative goals to them. And they live and die by the charity of others, which is another whole theme of this entire fucking movie. It's like, how the hell is this doing this? This movie is absurd. We're watching all these crazy things happen, and it's so emotionally well thought out. What the hell? It foregoes the heavy-handed religious imagery with, like, undercutting it with a lot of very in-your-face absurd religious imagery, which then somehow still comes back around to being biblical in nature. It's like, what? How,
guys,
was the stripper lady actually an angel?
Who knows? Guys, anyone listening to this, if you have not seen a Satoshi Kon movie, go ahead and watch Tokyo Godfathers. Watch any of them. They're not all exactly like this, but they all have, like, similar themes, and they're so well thought out. Like, Paprika, Perfect Blue. I haven't seen Millennium Actress, but I hear people say that that's great too. Satoshi Kon's just a great filmmaker. It's one of those things like Hosoda and Oshii, where I think they get lost in the sea of Miyazaki love over here. But there's tons of, like, great Japanese animated features that aren't based on shonen manga like One Piece and Dragon Ball.
No. It's like, you know, there's a place for that, but...
No, of course.
Like, yeah, we can all agree. It's badass. However, there's also a place for, you know, a deconstruction of modern society and through the lens of its most downtrodden individuals, including, not limited to, substance abuse, abandonment, control issues, transgenderism, among a lot of other things.
Yeah.
And this was in 2003.
Yeah.
Like, I fully went into this. Like, when I saw that one of the main characters was trans, I was like, oh man, this is going to be rough. Because it's like, we can all remember that the early 2000s were not exactly, like, it was in that era where we learned that, hey, we can start, like, we can make fun of gay people without it being too overtly homophobic, only mostly. So, I was fully going into this thinking, like, okay, it's going to be a whole thing where they're poking fun at this character, and it's just going to be, annoying. I will say, there's a few moments of that, but at the same time, there are moments that come from a very real place. Like, it's characters criticizing Hana for the fact that she wants to be the mother, and the fact that she biologically can't have a child, and it's... just, it's very interesting of just seeing the reactions to it. And it's like, I mean, that's a real thing to say, I guess. It's coming from the mouth of people who are being hurtful deliberately at the time. So it's got a weird balance to it. I think it actually does pretty well with it. Again, this is coming from someone who is not even remotely trans, so I can't necessarily say I'm an expert on this, so I'm not going to try to. But
right.
I don't know. I was very pleasantly surprised. And again, this is in comparison to John Wayne's shit.
Yeah. But also, it's like, it's from a place of where the characters even mention this at one point, where it's like, Hana tells that to Miyuki when they're leaving the hospital. It's like, sometimes you say the things that are the most hurtful to the ones that you care about the most. And I think that's a lot of what goes on, not just with their interaction, I mean, overall with their interactions, but we can boil that down to the transgenderism thing too, because even for the shit that he says, both of them still refer to Hana with female pronouns and, you know, that woman's gonna kill me, you're not my wife, you know, so there's still recognition there. It's just sometimes they lose it and they're in a horrible situation, so they are all being horrible to one another, and they're saying the things that they know are the most hurtful. So in that way, it's also very real.
And to my knowledge, I don't know if there's ever an occasion where a side character even misgenders Hana specifically. Like, there might be a moment where, I don't think there actually is a moment of it. I think they fully are just respective of it. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And again, like I said, this is just in comparison to the saccharine bull that is Three Godfathers. I'm just like, man, this is a jump.
I gotta say, and I know it's a John Wayne movie for whatever it's worth, but I could even put aside how direct they're being with the biblical references and just be like, okay, you know, maybe they think their audience is stupid, and so they're not going to let them think for themselves. And me and you even talked about this off recording, but it's not just New Jerusalem. They make it even more direct by stating that there's a Cairo and a Damascus nearby as well, which is like, okay, just calm down. But I could forgive all of that, but they undo so much of what makes Hell's Heroes work by letting John Wayne live at the end. And not just but it's like, the judge is like, I thought you would say that. Here's a reward. You have a reduced sentence and you will keep custody of this kid who is not yours.
Ho, ho, ho. I've been Santa this whole time, and I'm a representation of the bullshit that is the justice system or something. That's more credit than it deserves.
Is it because it's the Wild West? What is this legal mumbo jumbo that means that John Wayne's word that the woman said that he was the child's godfather means that legally he has custody of the child? It feels more like Finders Keepers Wild West law than anything else. There's no witnesses.
And this is from a man that they all well know to be an active criminal. Like, he could be saying fucking anything to get his ass from going to jail. Like,
if I was the sheriff, I'd be like, I think you killed my niece and then you felt bad. Like,
I'm gonna shoot you dead because you are absolutely a criminal. Like, what?
You
got shot for so little back then.
And maybe we're being pedants at this point, but like, it spits directly in the face of what I think is a perfectly good troublesome moral story about, like, the, you know, how these outlaws or outcasts can come together and think about something bigger than themselves in the moment.
And you know something? I'm just gonna have to say it. It harkens back to Infernal Affairs and The Departed. Because I imagine you might be able to pick up on what I mean here. In the original Infernal Affairs, the movie that The Departed is based on, the whole thing, as we even noted in our review, the whole thing has a sort of yin-yang relationship between the undercover cop character and the undercover criminal character, where the undercover cop character starts off from a moral high ground, but in time slowly is beaten down by the system and eventually has a moment of darkness in the end where he attempts to effectively kidnap the undercover criminal character, and just before he's able to get away with it, he is shot and killed. Meanwhile, the undercover criminal character starts off from the moral low point of obviously being a criminal in the police situation, but eventually realizes that, no, he's better than what he is, and it, like, turns on the, you know, his criminal benefactor, and ultimately is able to honor the memory of the undercover cop who had originally was about to expose him as a traitor. And so he goes on to live and live effectively as a hero, but in a bittersweet sense for the fact that another man had to die for it. In The Departed, it's like that. Except then also at the end, the undercover criminal character gets killed by Mark Wahlberg, and then that's just the end of the movie. So any emotional symmetry, any emotional kind of, like, reflection is completely lost, because he's just dead. It was just a story about criminals being shitty to each other, and then there's a rat on the windowsill, and it's just terrible. That's what this is. That's what Hell's Heroes versus Three Godfathers is. It's, we had an original with a very engrossing and interesting moral dilemma, and a story of self-sacrifice that turned into a saccharine romp just because the character, in this case, didn't die.
Yeah. Anytime.
Yeah, I just, I bring that up fairly often. I know I bring up the Departed fairly often. That's mainly just to shit on it. In this case, it's actually a genuine comparison I just realized of why do people do this? Why do they decide to completely alter the emotional core and emotional climax of a story for what they believe to be the better ending? It wasn't. The John Wayne's character should have been lying stone cold dead in the desert. And for some reason, Mark Wahlberg shouldn't have shown up.
And that's the thing, too, that really should be binding all these films together is that regardless of their situation, their circumstance, and the final outcome of the movie, all of these characters are selfish and they need to learn to get over themselves. Yeah. Like, Hell's Heroes, obviously, they're outlaws. They're robbers, and that extends into the Three Godfathers as well. You know, all these characters are not in the moral right, and if we want to go to Tokyo Godfathers, which is more complicated, I mean, Miyuki runs away from home and treats everything, you know, she puts her family through so much stress and grief. She's been gone for 6 months, and she does this through a misunderstanding that she took too far. She's being selfish she's not thinking of others, she's only thinking of herself and her inability to confront things like that. And Gin, you know, abandoned his family because he was no good he was a gambler and a drinker, and, you know, he's selfish in that regard. And even Hana, who her backstory doesn't state much about that, but the fact that she's unable to reconcile and is the one that desperately wants to keep the child to meet her own needs, that's selfish in its own right, and all of these characters have to get over that to think about something that's bigger than themselves. And in Three Godfathers, like you said, they lose the money pretty immediately. There's nothing for them to really give up. They're just taking care of a child in the desert. They don't abandon anything. I guess the closest thing that you could come to abandoning is John Wayne returning to a town, knowing that, well, even then that doesn't work because it's a different town. It's New Jerusalem. He doesn't necessarily know that the sheriff's going to trap him there, so he's not giving up the potential for future freedom. And he's also the only character that's rewarded for it. The three homeless individuals in Tokyo Godfather are not necessarily rewarded for taking care of this child and bringing it back. Their reward is that they are not dead after everything that they've been through. And they're definitely not rewarded in Hell's Heroes because all the characters are gone. Yeah. So Three Godfathers does not work.
Yeah, no, it just doesn't. I guess, to be fair, Tokyo Godfathers, it does end with them getting a lottery ticket, which I know is kind of more circumstantial, but I think it's meant to be, like, their thematic reward. But, yeah, as far as it goes, it's definitely not in the Hell's Heroes level. I'm sorry, not in the Three Godfathers level of, because of your actions, I am specifically rewarding you. Instead, it's, we just went through some crazy bullshit, and this kind of wacky old man who died on my watch, which I gotta say, the funniest character in the fucking movie was that old man who then died. It's just so funny. This is like you think he dies, and then he does the thing where he moves his hand over their eyes to close them, but then they just get open wider, and he's like, I'm not dead yet, can I have another drink? I'm like, Jesus.
More sake, please.
Can we also just talk about how funny Tokyo Godfathers actually is? Because it's a genuinely funny movie. I fully did not expect that going into this. Like, there's the moment where they find the one couple's house that's been demolished, and the way they test it to make sure if it's the house is to go to the somehow still standing front door to unlock it, and he just comes in, he goes, I'm home, and then the door just falls over. it's just so, and the way they just drag it out, because it's such a long, silent shot after he says that, and just the door just slowly just creaks to the ground. It's so genuinely funny in so many moments. It's like, what the fuck is happening? This is so strange. We watched a man get shot 3 times earlier. We watched an old man get his corpse beaten up by shithole teenagers.
Yeah, he was already dead and then he got kicked. The movie is not just funny, but it's animated well too, and not just like theatrical animation. It looks well, like a lot of people can say for like a Miyazaki picture or something. It's like the movie is animated well, but also takes advantage of the fact that it's animation. Anytime one of the characters goes off on someone, like when Hana, I think Hana has the best reactions in the movie. When she goes off at the hospital, her facial expressions are wild. And when they're in the cab, in an earlier scene, and she's describing her ideal man, her face literally morphs into that of the cab driver while she's talking. It's like, it's so strange, and it's something you have to be watching to see it happen, but it's like,
there's a rubberiness.
I'm not watching it and wondering, is she a shapeshifter that she can do that? No, it's a fucking cartoon, and they're having fun.
It's like there's a beauty in Japanese animation where they're willing to do that sort of thing. Where like it's just kind of a part of just the popular zeitgeist of that style of animation is allowed to just do shit that's just kind of outlandish like that, which you don't really get in a whole lot of, like, more serious, you know, Western animation. I get the biggest I can think of being, like, you know, Into the Spider-Verse, but that's kind of the whole point of it, is that it's meant to, you know, ape various animation styles.
Yeah, and even then, the characters tend to stay on model. I think that, yeah. Like, especially in recent years, the only show that I can think of that doesn't care about models would be OKKO.
Yeah.
They consistently spit in the face of using character model sheets and just did whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
Homestar Runner.
Oh, well, yeah. If we...
But that's a whole other... That should be a whole other genre.
Internet animation.
Yeah, true, Jesus. But yeah, it's... God, it is just a fascinating little romp of a movie, Tokyo Godfathers. And the fact that it's only an hour and a half long, I'm like, how the hell did they put all of this in here? Like, there's so much going on. It's as long as Three Godfathers, and yet it feels like three times as much movie, which, like, yeah, I don't know. I feel like this is just a consistent moment of switching back and forth between praising Tokyo Godfathers and absolutely shitting on Three Godfathers, and recognizing that the original Hell's Heroes did a very good job establishing a very cool concept.
Yeah, honestly, I feel bad because I don't feel like I'm talking about Hell's Heroes enough and just using it as a comparison point, but it's not, like, super revolutionary in anything it does, and it's not, like, big names that we can relate back to. It's a good telling of a story in a short, condensed form that doesn't overstay its welcome, and I think that it's a good comparison point to these other two movies that have a lot more going on because they have more cinematic history to work with. Some of it for the better, and some of it for worse.
Which, by the way, Hell's Heroes is actually on YouTube for free these days, so if any of you folks ever want to see it, it's pretty damn good. It's only about an hour. It's a damn solid Western. And then also just has a good thematic core.
Also, Three Godfathers is currently free on YouTube. You don't have to watch that one.
No. Also, the only one I found on there had, Russian subtitles, which, like, isn't a problem. It was just like, oh, that's just kind of annoying.
Oh, really? Mine did not have that problem. Mine was on a channel that's, like, it's called, like, Classic Action. Vintage Action Movies is the YouTube channel, and it's just, like, a bunch of Western and action movies from the 40s to the 70s that some person's just uploading to YouTube.
What
got away with that?
What Gopnik channel did I find, then?
I have no idea. You watched yours in 18 parts.
It was all in a solid piece. That's the funny part. I did fully think that, though, of, like, man, I'm normally used to watching this in, like, 20 or so randomized pieces, like, with this experience, but here we are. It's like the time I watched The Wolf of Wall Street that was, for some reason, on... Oh, was it Daily Motion? It was Daily Motion or Vimeo. I just found it apropos of nothing, and it just had, I think... I want to say Swahili subtitles? And it was just like... I was just like, you know what, I've never seen this, and I don't care to pay for it. I'll just watch it. I watched it, didn't really care for it. I was like, all right, glad I didn't pay anything for that.
That reminds me of when we watched, another anime film, when we watched Metropolis.
Oh my god!
4 years ago, I had two versions running on my PC at the same time while I was watching it. There was the, English version, the dub, that was in awful quality.
Yeah.
And it was playing in the background, and then I had the Japanese version that was in pristine quality but had no subtitles. So I had to start them both at the same time so that the audio would sync up and I could watch the one that was, you know, watchable. That's why I watched the dub of that one, because it's like, oh, this subtitle version has no subtitles. I don't know what they're saying. So
yeah, I had a similar experience with that one where I found one, it was the dub that was in pretty decent quality. And it had English subtitles as well, but for some reason, there was a function to change where the subtitles would be popping up at what time. So I had to, like, enter, it was in a matter of milliseconds. I had to type in random numbers to try and sync up the subtitles to the audio, because at times I need subtitles sometimes, especially for some of these bigger films where they talk kind of fast and I just miss details. And so I just managed to somehow bootleg my way through this incredibly weird version of it. And... No, it's one of the most unique film-watching experiences I've ever had. Not least of which for the fact that I was also watching the anime Metropolis movie.
Yes, which is still one of my favorite experiences.
Oh my god, that show. There is not a single moment of having to watch that movie where I did not enjoy every second of it.
I can say that, I think, for all the anime movies that we've covered on the show. Even The Secret World of Arrietty was a little sleepy, but it has great animation. It's hard to ignore, so.
The less we said about the remake of Ghost in the Shell, the better. But
yeah.
My goodness gracious. Yeah, I think we're just, like, I don't know whether we're just starved for more unique, like, viewpoints of things, for the fact that, yeah, consistently whenever we have anime, like, anime versions of something on this show, we've always leaned towards it. And it's just been just such a fun romp and just enjoyable experience to have these. Like the fact that, you know, obviously, we, you know, with SeaWorld Air Yeti alone, we got to see Studio Ghibli stuff. But yeah, it's just, I don't know what it is exactly. It's that we're just like, yeah, we love this.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's hard to take it past that point, but I think that, I mean, I'm already an animation fan.
Oh, yeah.
The heightening and the humor of Tokyo Godfathers just sets it well above all the rest for me. But Hell's Heroes, for as succinct and short and, you know, easily digestible as it is, as well for the fact that it doesn't fuck the story up, it's not too far behind Tokyo Godfathers. And then Three Godfathers, I think I ranked as like 2 stars on Letterboxd. I was like, it looks nice.
Yeah.
it's like Harry Jr.
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of fun seeing like both sides of the spectrum with these stories. Like, we had the very, very American style of, you know, production that's very directly biblical. It has a lot to do with like Westerns and everything, and that sort of like self-sacrifice mentality, versus the very Japanese style of it, you know, set in the city and everything. There's a very kind of modernist sensibility to it, and with a bit more of a positive outlook on the end of it. It's very interesting. They both feel, they're the same story at their core, but they both kind of epitomize different values going through them. And it's just very interesting to see like how they actually compare to each other. And then watching, you know, John Wayne be John Wayne and reminding me that, oh yeah, I don't like John Wayne. I truly don't believe there's ever been a John Wayne movie other than maybe True Grit, where I didn't just like roll my eyes so hard they fell out of my head.
Yeah. I'm not a fan. And it's one of those things where he became such a figure that I'm sure there's a handful of movies where he dies in them, but watching Three Godfathers and he like lives through the ending is rewarded. I can't say I was surprised, just disappointed, because John Wayne, even in 1948, John Wayne does not seem like the person that you kill in your movie. I was like, that's John Wayne.
Just again, harkens back to True Grit, where he just like has a nice life at the end of it, versus the remake where it's just like, no, he just dies off screen. Like, all right, whatever.
Yeah. No, you can kill Jeff Bridges all you want.
Oh yeah, that man gets his ass killed a few times and throughout movies. Yeah, not terribly often. He still tends to be the leading man, but you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my final thoughts. I don't know if you have any additional follow up there.
It's pretty much as dead on as it can be for me. I definitely like Hell's Heroes, but I think Tokyo Godfathers is far and beyond even better. It's so emotionally complex and still also a satisfying movie. Like, yeah, I like how it ended. I know it's a little saccharine, but it's built itself up of being a bit of a saccharine film. And quite honestly, with all the other bullshit that happens, it earns it, you know? It talks about these characters having pretty rough lives and having strange emotional turbulence that they've had to deal with. It's like, you know what? Yeah, give them the winning lottery ticket. They deserve it.
Well, and that's the thing, too, is that, yeah, in Hell's Heroes, it's like, okay, well, they robbed a bank, and then they're in the desert, and they all die in the desert. But some of these instances in Tokyo Godfathers is like, man, these guys might be better off if they had just died at some point, because they have to deal with kidnapping and fears of sex trafficking and suicide and assault and just dealing with the Yakuza, even if you are on relatively friendly terms. Like, I'd be fucking stressed out. I'd be like, oh my God, I shouldn't be here right now.
Yeah.
it's a miserable time.
Meanwhile, the constant threat of the fact that they are homeless and starving.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we can't even sit in the warmth of a store. We're going to be thrown out because we smell.
We are as downtrodden as this society can allow us to be, effectively. Like, my God. It is. Man, yeah, it's just like at a certain point you're like, man, I feel bad for y'all, but good Lord, I don't think I'd have the stomach to keep on going. Which, like, I guess is meant to be a credit to them as, like, characters, but still.
Yeah. No, definitely. And I, you know what? I like how open-ended the ending of Tokyo Godfathers is as well. Because, sure, there's that lottery ticket that they obtained, and they're the godfathers of these individuals, but it literally cuts off with Miyuki technically reuniting with her police father, but it's not like an actual reunion. It's just like they see each other, they recognize each other, and then the movie ends. You don't know how that relationship goes. You don't know if all these characters are definitely going their separate ways, because they all technically have places and people to go to. You don't know what they're going to do with the money, if anything. It's
don't know if, you know, you don't know if the girl is going to get sent to juvie for stabbing her father.
Yeah, there's no actual like tying up of loose ends, because there doesn't really need to be. It's similar to the Scorsese film. It's similar to the Scorsese film I talked about earlier this year that I really like, After Hours, where it's, if you look at it from the outset, it's just a bunch of stuff that happens to a guy. Like, a yuppie gets lost downtown and literally has the most miserable night of his life as he is assaulted and tortured by numerous goings on. And
I feel like that's happened to every yuppie at one point in their lives when you think about it.
Yeah, what made them this way?
Like, was it the yuppie that caused the problem, or did the problem cause the yuppie?
'Twas tragedy that made the yuppie.
'Twas Wall Street that killed the beast.
Yes, but yeah, I think those are our final thoughts. I don't think it doesn't sound like we have anything else necessarily to say about any of these three movies.
Just go see Tokyo Godfathers. It's on Amazon. You can rent it. It's fantastic. It's actually like about 40 cents cheaper than their usual rentals. I saw that and I was like, well, that's interesting and slightly insulting.
Yeah, go watch Tokyo Godfathers. Just go watch Satoshi Kon's stuff in general. Gone too soon. I wish he was around to still be making things.
Oh my god, we could use him these days.
I think this actually might have been his last movie. He died in like 2011 or something.
Oh yeah.
But as depressing as that is, we will move on to questions. I don't know if you have anything this time around, but I know I do.
I might be able to come up with something by the end, but I gotta be honest, this movie, I couldn't... It hasn't garnered fun hypotheticals in my mind. It's got a combination of, wow, the West is rough, and dear God, I feel bad for these people. And then also, why is John Wayne still so popular?
No worries on that. We don't both have to have something every time. I just think it's a fun exercise. But mine for this time is outside of the realm of the actual movies themselves. But just what do you think would be an interesting anime feature adaptation of a timeless holiday movie?
Oh, a timeless holiday movie specifically?
Any holiday movie, but you know. Because I wouldn't call Three Godfathers timeless necessarily.
Oh, fair. No, fair, fair. People aren't I would like to see an anime reinterpretation of the Santa Claus, but through a more Shintoist lens. Someone accidentally kills there are several Shintoism gods that I'm aware of, but I can't name one specifically. But there's one that's represented by the fox, I think specifically. Like someone accidentally runs over a fox, and it turns out to be like this Shintoist deity woman, and they are forced to replace them, and they have to learn how to be this, you know, animism god, essentially.
Okay.
I think that would be hilarious. And I don't know if that's a sacrilegious statement to talk about, but you know what? That shit tends to happen in a lot of those polytheistic, you know, religious groups of, hey, here's a guy, he did some wild shit, now he's a god. That just happened. That happens surprisingly often in a lot of older cultures.
Oh, man.
So I think that would be hilarious and also very interesting.
You know what? I'm going to allow this. I'm going to roll with this.
Okay, cool. Thank you. I'm glad you are the, I'm glad that you are the, you know, progenitor of this.
Yeah, I'm financing, I'm bankrolling these movies.
I think it's either Kitsune or Inari is the god that I'm thinking of in Shintoism. I don't know.
Oh, it's been a minute. Actually, I'm glad that you said that, but isn't it Inari? And I think the only reason I know that is because Inari, I think it's Inari Okami.
That's true. Yes. Yeah, the guy. I think I want to say Kitsune might just be the word for fox in Japanese. It is Inari. Yes.
Excellent. I'm glad that we pieced that together. Together we make one functioning human being.
Who has one functioning human being with a borderline functional understanding of light Shintoism. Stretch by any other name. But what about you? I'm curious to know what you might do with this concept.
I think it would be interesting to. So I know that we had the samurai Batman that ended up coming out. And I have not seen it. I've heard moderate to mixed things, but I think it would be really interesting to have an anime adaptation of Batman Returns. Because that takes place entirely at Christmas, and
nice.
But make him a ninja. I want Batman to be a ninja, and he's fighting the Penguin and Michelle Pfeiffer at Christmas time.
I dig it. I like that.
Michelle Pfeiffer instead of Catwoman. Catwoman's not there. It's Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
Penguin.
Yeah, no, fair. I think, yeah, no, I can see that. I can see Penguin animized. Is that the term? I don't know.
Like a little goblin, and he has the head of that persona troll.
That's exactly what that is. I was like, I haven't played Persona, but I know exactly who you're talking about. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I was about to make a joke also of like, what about an anime version of Die Hard? Because obviously, like, there's the joke of it being a Christmas movie. But then I thought, well, they sort of did that with The Raid. But I remembered, no, The Raid's a live action movie, and also it might be Indonesian. I don't think there's a lot of things that I got wrong in that assumption. So who's to say?
What a train of thought.
This is what goes through my brain on like a constant basis, y'all. Like this is the ADHD lifestyle. I went from, okay, Christmas, action movie, Die Hard, because it's sort of like that. Oh, wait, they did an action movie that's a lot like Die Hard. It's The Raid, but it has nothing to do with Christmas. And also, it's not animated, which is the whole point of this exercise. I am useless.
I'm defeated.
Oh my God. Oh, man. That was a train of thought that just, like, crashed. It's someone built a train track that specifically went straight into the sheer side of a cliff. Like, it didn't, like, break off or, like, whatever. No, they designed it to go in crash. That was that train of thought.
That was a trek to get there.
Oh, my God. Yeah, in the time frame that has come with, I was not able to come up with another question. The most I could sort of jokingly think of is, if you had to wipe out any old actor, well, any old famous actor from existence, who would you pick? And I realized I just wanted to pick Don Wayne, so.
I don't even know how I would answer that, so.
Yeah, so, I don't know. I got nothing on that end.
No, that's perfectly fine.
I couldn't really think of any kind of question to relate to Tokyo Godfathers that didn't just kind of draw away from the impact of that film, where I'm just like, I'm either going to say something that's going to come off either rude or insensitive, or I'm going to just come off of something that's just boring. So I'm not going to try.
So how would you fix the problem of the unhoused?
Oh, dear God. Like, dear merciful God.
It's a movie podcast.
Well, I'll tell you about a movie, The Purge.
Oh my God.
Yeah, you want to bring it dark? It's
like, I don't know if I should hop into socials now. I don't think
I'm already... I recognize that I've been canceled now. It's fine.
No, that's okay.
to be fair, that is one of the themes in The Purge. Is the
no, them being... A great movie series that is. I guess we'll leave Anime Christmas behind and we'll go ahead and hop into socials. So go ahead and subscribe and follow us on any of your favorite podcasting platforms. We're on Apple Podcast, Spreaker, Podbay, Podomatic, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, YouTube. But we are hosted on Spotify for Podcasters. Go ahead and send us an email, theyremadeit@gmail.com, with any suggestions for future episodes, positives about the podcast, negatives about the podcast. If you want to answer this week's question, go ahead. We're always open ears to that.
We love hearing from that.
I do. I love hearing from that, yes. And go ahead and follow us at @itremade on Twitter for updates on when new episodes of the podcast are going live, potential future episodes that we may cover someday, little full circle diagrams that I've been putting together regarding people that we've covered on the show more than once, and posters and details for things that we found interesting and have talked about on the show, books, music, movies, games, etc. And that is it for socials.
Well, fantastic. I gotta say, Jake, this was an interesting and surprisingly nice choice this time around. I gotta say, whenever there's the... You know, there have been occasions where I think when you first suggested these movies to me, I was like, are you sure these are all related?
Yes.
Hell's Heroes to Three Godfathers to Tokyo Godfathers. And I was like, okay, I can sort of see a connection between two of them. However, if anything, the two that sound like they're connected are the two least connected.
Yes, exactly. It's a wonderful web we weave, and I'm always a little worried whenever we do a three movie one, just because I'm always worried about how it's going to turn out with us talking about three films. But we've done that four times now, and I think it's worked every single time. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's done pretty well, with a mild exception of Godfather Part Three, just because, dear God,
the conversation went well.
The conversation went well, yeah, for sure. But it's always interesting doing kind of the three movie episode, but perhaps. Would you consider a three-person episode?
I've given it some thoughts, but I don't think my uncle wants to come on.
Well, I might have someone else for that, which you all will get to hear about next time around for our little season finale. A little special treat for this one.
Excellent. I'm on the edge of my seat.
Huzzah. Well, with that rare little cliffhanger dropped out there for y'all, as always, I am your host, Stuart.
And I'm your host, Jacob.
And have a good night and a wonderful winter season.
If I had a sick polecat, I wouldn't send for that Doc Meacham. A week without a bath. Well, that's all right for a grown boy that ain't supposed to bathe between water holes. Or in town on Saturday night, sparking his gal. But a baby. I'll lay my silver spurs that Doc's wrong.
Come again, kid. Immediately after birth, the nurse should rub the baby's body with olive oil. Or if olive oil is not available, with some clean, pure lard or grease.